This is a segment from The Annex, an academic sociology-themed podcast. For more, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com. And now we turn to Mark Horowitz from Seton Hall. Mark wrote Sociology, Sacred Victims, and the Politics of Knowledge, Moral Foundations Theory, and Disciplinary Controversies in the American Sociologist. It's an interesting piece that turns the lens back on our discipline. My first reaction to your piece, Mark, was, oh, wow, this could get us arguing for hours. And then, you know what? I was doing show prep this morning, and I thought to myself, wow, this can be a topic that people react badly to in a way, right? It makes a lot of points that I think could be taken negatively, and this is why. We're talking about our own community's taboos, and when you discuss a taboo as a cultural artifact as opposed to an objective truth, you make violating that taboo more logically viable, right? Mm-hmm. And Mark's paper touches on a lot of discussions about us that are going on in the broader public sphere, and they're discussions that I don't think we're having internally. I spoke to Mark, and Mark is just really great at gingerly navigating these issues. And so I'm really grateful to have you come on to talk to us about some very brave research that you're putting out, Mark. I have to tip my hat to you.
Well, I appreciate that. I'm certainly delighted to be on to discuss it. Do you mind if I say just a few words about the broader project before homing in on this pace?
Please.
Just very briefly, because it's been about 4 or 5 years that my colleagues and I have been examining controversies within the social sciences. Mm-hmm. So at this point, we've done major surveys, a couple of them of anthropologists. This is the second we've done of sociologists, mm-hmm. one of economists, and we're working on right now one of developmental psychologists. Mm-hmm. So what we do is we examine these controversies from the standpoint of a school of social psychology or political psychology mm-hmm. Called Moral Foundations Theory. It's associated with Jonathan Haidt. You're familiar with him, I'm not sure.
Can you just spell it out for us?
Yeah, sure.
Moral Foundations Theory.
Yeah, Moral Foundations Theory, it's very complicated and barks a lot of threads, but the basic idea is that undergirding our political beliefs mm-hmm. are certain moral intuitions or emotions that have a deep evolutionary history. Mm-hmm. So Moral Foundations Theory has a kind of innatist element to it, but it's certainly not deterministic. It talks about pre-wiring and first drafts of our sort of emotion complexes that end up in tandem with our socialization to crystallize into certain political identities and sensibilities. So what I do is I use Moral Foundation Theory to discuss controversies within social science fields and see how those controversies often are largely predicted, if you would, by scholars' political orientation. So if you go to a controversy in economics, you go to a controversy in sociology, mm-hmm. whatever the social science field is, and you know what the social scientist political orientation is, mm-hmm. you can make a really decent guess about where they're going to stand on a particular empirical matter in their field, huh. especially these sensitive empirical questions like the ones in Sacred Victims, right? Huh. So I map that, demonstrate it across social science. We map it, we demonstrate it across these social science fields, and then we tentatively explain it using this kind of framework that, again, brings in evolutionary theory. I know that's unusual for sociologists mm-hmm. to entertain a kind of evolved biology in what we do, but I find it quite plausible.
I want to get to it for a bit, but I'd like to start by setting us up with Sociology, Sacred Victims. Can you tell us about the paper?
Absolutely. Yeah. So we sent out a survey to, I think the final end might have been 479. We used the U.S. News and World Report, national universities, liberal arts colleges, and literally went to every single sociologist we could find in all of those schools. Mm. And I can't remember the exact response rate, but we ended up with a N of about 450, 470. Mm-hmm. And we asked sociologists a number of questions about controversies that are quite divisive in their fields. Mm-hmm. And we explore the extent to which political orientation and other variables, it turns out gender is also significant. The paradigm that you use in sociology is also significantly associated with where you stand. Mm-hmm. I can go into detail about that if you're interested. Yeah. But we didn't shirk from going to some really sensitive issues. So we looked at whether, kind of revisiting the old culture of poverty question, mm-hmm. whether cultural practices within the inner city can play at least some independent role in tandem with these more decisive structural factors in perpetuating poverty, specifically in the Black community. We looked at gendered occupational choice and whether there could be, in tandem with socialization and sexism, could there also be a kind of average biological difference between men and women that plays some role in the unequal distribution across work roles in the economy. And then
The Larry Summers argument.
We directly revisited the Larry Summers issue. And then finally, immigration, and then the question of whether immigration flows can impact this is language usually used by conservatives, but like the cultural cohesion or the social cohesion of society, whether there can be drawbacks and whether we should have policy on immigration informed mm-hmm. by data on whether immigration can be harmful. So those three very sensitive issues, and on question after question, we found that a sociologist's politics largely predict their opinion on it.
So you say that there's ideological blind spots, that we have sort of worldview commitments that structure our thoughts and our empirical analyses too. So it's like a type of groupthink, right? Where we often fail to recognize the structuring our views. So what is the sociologist's worldview? Where are these taboos? I guess you kind of went over that, right, in your thing.
Well, it's to the extent that people on the liberal left end mm-hmm. of the political spectrum have underlying moral sensitivities. I mean, the cliche mm-hmm. of like the bleeding heart liberal, I actually think is just actually factually true. Mm-hmm. There's some truth to it, that people on the left of this political spectrum literally emote more, like suffer more for the vulnerable. Mm-hmm. I'm not waving a flag, like celebrating us and saying that. I'm simply pointing it out. I think it's empirically true. Worry about the polar bear more mm-hmm. kind of thing, you know, with climate change. And that sort of sensibility, we construct, and when we interact with people that have like-minded sensibilities, we tend to sort of inadvertently or consciously police people with those same sensibilities. So certain kinds of questions we find very inviting. So people on the very far left of the field, which makes up a large percentage of people in the field, there's mm-hmm. virtually no conservatives or libertarians in sociology. Mm-hmm. Those people on the far left will find inviting critical analyses of power. You know, why all the attention on intersectionality and how these both conscious bigotry and more impersonal processes disadvantage vulnerable groups? Well, because it resonates with us.
Right.
And we care deeply about these groups. And we also have a strong anti-authoritarian impulse, a kind of distrust toward a bully or toward a leader. Mm-hmm. So those sorts of moral sensitivities, I think, inform the kinds of questions we ask and oftentimes render taboo certain kinds of claims that I think have at least some degree of plausibility.
Okay, so in reading this article, one of the things that I was interested in is the whole like Weingart and Weingart's, you know, argument that much of sociology adheres to this concept of sacred cosmic egalitarianism, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
Which I guess is the belief that all ethnic and cultural and social and, you know, whatever gender groups are all, you know, pretty much inherently equal, right? Like along a line of socially desirable traits, right? And the thing is, right? So I get that, right? I don't think all of sociology adheres to this, right? But I think a lot of sociology does. You know, it says, basically says, we're going to take as a given that everyone is equal, right? Along these traits, right? Unless, you know, empirical evidence shows me otherwise. One of the things I find interesting is that there are other disciplines, right, that take the opposite as a given, right? They take as a given that, you know what, these different groups are inherently unequal in terms of the distribution of these desirable traits. And we take that as a given unless you prove otherwise empirically, right? So how much, I'm wondering how much of sort of this difference is about a lack of objectivity versus a difference in the basic assumptions, right, that different disciplines make about groups and group differences, right, and what each discipline constitutes as proof.
I think that it's interesting you said, Leslie, that disciplines feel that these groups are like essentially mm-hmm. unequal or something like that. I mean, there's the empirical reality, obviously. If mm-hmm. we look at the racial ethnic hierarchy, for example, we're going to find Black and brown people with less on average access to socially valued goods. Mm-hmm. I mean, the real rub is how we explain that. And I think people in sociology, particularly those with liberal left sensibilities, are going to find very congenial arguments that speak to unjust power, that speak to, you know, we're all essentially the same in our traits, so it must be some external force. Mm-hmm. That, you know, so to go to the example of gendered occupational choice, I cite, I don't know if you remember from the article, but I cite one of the respondents who says, well, I have to just out myself right here. Mm-hmm. You know, I find that biology does matter. I think social factors matter more. And kind of this very apologetic spirit. Mm-hmm. But I mean, at the end of the day, if it's the case that there could be an average biological difference between men and women that plays a role in the distribution of work roles, then we need to sort of address that and not have our political and moral sensitivities render it off limits. And her sort of defensiveness, and it was interesting when I was, because we provided comment boxes after all of our questions. We have this just massively rich data source that I certainly could plumb for future studies if I wished, but just a lot of self-censorship, a lot of expressions of people saying, I think certain things, I just don't feel like I can say it. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of what we're getting at. I think on both sides, I don't know about academic fields that look at it the other way, but certainly the political right does. The political right dismisses social structure. You know, far right thinks it's all just culture of poverty, for example, on the mm-hmm. on the question of inner city poverty. So I think that they're empirically wrong, due in large part because of their moral sensibilities and differences. Not solely, but that's part of the story. So it's a complicated, sorry if I'm going in different directions, but go ahead.
No.
I'm sorry, Joe.
No, please. So I'm getting the gist of your argument to involve some type of process where we self-select into these disciplines based on either biological or at least prior sort of affinities towards egalitarian arguments or towards empathy or towards, you know, nurturant behavior or something like that. Is that the main thrust of sort of the worldview that led you into this?
Absolutely. I think you hit the nail on the head there. And I would also play, we self-select, but there's also people who are, you know, who are grooming us as mm-hmm. faculty. Then we go into the academic market. And it's not only about the empirical work that we do. Mm-hmm. It's a certain moral orientation to the world mm-hmm. that gets rewarded, that if you're on the liberal left and you demonstrate sufficient commitment to those things, you're going to be attractive to people who share those same sensibilities. It's not a grand conspiracy. It's just the flow of how the institution works. People gravitate toward people that are like them.
Well,
so I agree with you wholeheartedly.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that you say that. It's kind of like living in Bethesda, which is where I live, where Bethesda is supposed to be this, like, I don't know, this like hotbed of like liberal thought, right? Mm-hmm. And so no matter what conversation you have with someone, right, someone will, you know, almost inevitably, I mean, it's right outside of DC, the conversation will turn to politics mm-hmm. and someone will start to demonstrate just how liberal they are, right? Mm-hmm. And you can tell the people who actually are coming at it from like, yeah, well, this is just part of my moral upbringing and this happened organically. And the people who have been socialized, right, within Bethesda to actually have certain talking points, right? And I think that we see that in the discipline as well. I think we see people, as you say, who self-select into it because they believe that in many ways, the discipline like is, you know, the more like the moral stance, right, mm-hmm. of the discipline, if it does have a moral stance, accords with theirs. And then there are others who find, well, I can do really good work here, right, yeah. In this discipline. Let me just make sure that, you know, whatever, I have adopted the language that is used in the discipline and yada, 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 right? Mm-hmm. So some of it is, I don't know. Some of it might be nature and some of it might be nurture and some of it might be the interaction. So
I think it's definitely all of those things. Yeah, gotcha.
No, you go, Mark. You go.
Yeah, okay. Well, I think it's all of those things. We try to unpack that in the paper. We talk about the underlying moral intuitions that nudge people toward particular fields. And we mm-hmm. talk about the process of professional socialization and how you're going to interact with like-minded people. It's going to reinforce. Mm-hmm. I think the danger comes in when it spills into a kind of shaming mm-hmm. where certain ideas are, and we have lots of examples in the paper that we've noticed right. in one of the sections where, you know, we present these vignettes, we talk about some research, Mm-hmm. And we get many comments the effect of, like, you know, shame on you researchers mm-hmm. for creating controversy. This issue's been settled long ago. This is, you know, arguing this is akin to saying, you know, that, you know, black people are underrepresented in STEM for biology reasons, things like this. He's very, very, it's very easy to tap a nerve, mm-hmm. even though we made every effort to sort of present the claims in an innocuous a fashion. And we also presented them in each way. So we have questions to the effect that, you know, institutional racism, social structure, poverty, these are the reasons for the perpetuation of poverty, mm-hmm. that any cultural reason is going to be negligible. We ask that, but we also ask it the other way, which says maybe cultural factors in the inner city, like a kind of street code, make a bad situation worse. Mm-hmm. But that spills into agency for vulnerable people and people with left liberal intuitions. We aren't comfortable with that. It's like, what are you saying? It's their fault? That's blaming the victim. Right. So, and then that's where all the shaming flows out of, I think.
Well, I mean, no, I'm not going to say what I was going to say.
Are you sure? All right.
I mean, basically, I mean, yeah, look, you know, the way I like one of the things when I first in my first year of graduate school, right, I remember so much the kind of like beating into our heads, like critical distance, being able to be totally objective, oh, yeah. Et cetera, right? And I remember, I mean, me, myself, being someone who, I mean, although I was born in Canada, right, I've lived here my entire life, basically, right? And I grew up in a low-income, racially segregated part of Brooklyn, mm-hmm. right? Where all of this quote-unquote culture of poverty, right? You know, I mean, that's where you would totally see it, right? And one of the things that I found interesting was that almost nobody who was studying things like culture of poverty within these kinds of settings were people like me who were like, well, you know, I'm a native, right? You know what I mean? Maybe I could help navigate, you know, some of this stuff. How much of it is culture? How much of it is a culture, right, that is enacted by a very small portion of the people within here, within that community, right? But they have maybe an outsized effect, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. And you know, I'm not saying that culture doesn't matter. What I do think is that very often people who aren't native to that culture, I think actually approach that culture and totally misapprehend what it is, right? And so that's my biggest problem with the whole culture of poverty thing is I think most of the people who study it actually don't really understand what they're studying.
So I feel like we've teased the paper enough. And what I love about the Sacred Victims paper is that you kind of do like Daniel Klein of George Mason does with The Economist. You go and show where the prevailing views are in the discipline. And what really struck me is the difference between what you see communicated to you sort of through elite culture through the publications and what the street culture of sociology believes. So this is the difference between the view of sociology that's transmitted to us either through our internal media or through the voices of prominent sociologists versus what you get when you try to get anonymous responses from the regular sociologist. And the two are very different, right? And I was hoping you could just go over the empirical findings of what you found there.
Before I do, quickly, Joe, when you say how mm-hmm. it's been transmitted, are you mm-hmm. referring to sort of the way conservative media frames like sociology just a whole bunch of leftist sort of thing and the kind of biases attendant to that, or do you have something else in mind?
There's that. There's also, I think, maybe a sense we've had high-profile people make very strong normative proclamations or, you know, there are high-profile people who convey a very strong view of what sociology's morality should be. And it okay. might be that you see those voices and you think that that reflects mainstream views, but sociology appears to be much more ideologically diverse than I would have suspected looking at your survey results.
I think you're absolutely right. And there's a number of questions that sort of attest to that. Mm-hmm. Like we asked sociologists about, say, whether it's going back to Leslie's point about what she learned in grad school, like is a dispassionate attitude in your research important, you know, to accurately explain phenomena, and you're going to see lots of division there. Should we separate advocacy and research, right? Would political conservatives, like more of them, benefit the discipline? I mean, the field's completely divided on that, and that might be surprising to people who have a stereotype about where the field is. It's about 30% saying it would be a good thing, 30% bad thing, and 40% undecided on that. So there's a whole cluster of questions like that that I think would be of interest that would defy that stereotype. I think in terms of our empirical findings that are most sort of important from the point of view of the theoretical perspective that we have, trying to explain the data, is the political differences. And we can go into gender differences, we can go into disciplinary subfield differences. The political differences are the most pronounced. So if you take a specific question, what you'll find is that radicals, liberals, and moderates systematically differ on a particular question. And, and part of the difficulty in conveying it succinctly is that we provide these vignettes, which I don't think we have time to read, which provide a little bit of context to the reader in terms of what's going on in the research prior to these. But just go, so just, I'll just point to a few of these just for purpose of discussion. The question of, you know, is it plausible that cultural factors play some role in perpetuating inner city poverty in the Black community? And 56% of radical sociologists say yes, 77% of liberal, and then 93% of moderate. So what you'll see, a question after question, you'll see a stairway like that, where, so let's see, I'm going to go to the other ones here.
There's some crazy views that I was surprised about. Like, for example, a third of your respondents felt women in people-oriented professions is partly biological.
Right.
I would not have expected that from sociologists, for a third to see a biological basis.
Well, let me just chime in with the politics of it. 16% of radicals think that, 35% of liberal sociologists, and then 39% of moderate. So the field as a whole, we try not to take positions so much on these things. We do sometimes, but that's not my main goal. My main goal is to understand ideology, not to engage in ideology critique. I don't want to be on a team shaming my fellow sociologists for their biases. It's not very helpful. I want to understand what undergirds why we're biased in the first place. And that said, though, on this particular issue, and this speaks a little to the blank slate, so maybe it's a segue that might be useful. On this particular issue, it just strikes me as plausible. I still feel a little defensive in this, but it just strikes me as pretty plausible from an evolutionary point of view that men and women would have different emotive tendencies that certainly get shaped and influenced by socialization. But the notion of putting a kind of like ideological fiat and saying, well, we are biologically, you know, different in terms of our genitalia, but we have no psychological differences. We sort of have to establish that at the outset. I don't find that convincing anymore. I used to when I was in graduate school, but I moved from total constructionism toward a view that's informed by evolutionary biology more and more.
Jeez, it's hard for me to get there on that one. I mean, listen, I will willingly concede that I probably share a lot of the biases of my colleagues, but geez, some of that stuff it would be hard for me to agree. And I see myself right in line.
Well, I think part of it is also that there is a strand of evolutionary biology, right, that is ridiculous, right? You know, like I've mentioned him before, but people like Rushton, right? And his whole evo bio theories about race, right? And how, you know, it's like different races have evolved in different ways, such that some have larger genitalia. And because they have larger genitalia, their brains are smaller, right? You know, that's just incredible. I mean, I'm sorry, that's ridiculous, right? And I think that strand of evolutionary biology, I think, lets us understand that, you know, it's not just the social sciences in which, you know, sort of politics might creep in order to shape and frame what it is we constitute as proof, right? And what we think of as evidence. But I mean, definitely for sure. I mean, during the 19th century, like in through the middle of the 20th century, we saw ways in which politics actually helped inform medical research, biomedical research, and biological research. So none of us is pure. Like, and no discipline, to my knowledge, has been totally free of the imperatives of our society, right? And, you know, and the norms of our society.
My take, I barely, literally barely familiar with Rushton, and my impression is I could be wrong, but that he's widely rejected by the vast majority of evolutionary biologists.
So now he is. But I mean, but Rushton was published, like had been published. I mean, he's dead now, but he had been published in some of the leading evolutionary biology journals, right? So if that's an indicator of acceptance, right?
When was he? When was Rushton active? I don't know any of this field.
Well, I think, I mean, Rushton just died a few years, not that long ago.
It's like,
right?
An 80s thing, or?
Another Canadian. Rushton was publishing at least through the late 90s, mm-hmm. right? And even into the early aughts, maybe. But I don't know if that was original research, because he was censured by his university for violating IRB rules. So
that's a common.
No, go, you go, Mark.
No, I was going to say, it's not uncommon for discussion of potential differences, say, between men and women that have an evolved aspect to sort of end up inviting this kind of historization of everything, you know, from social Darwinism to eugenics and everything else. And I don't know, my take on things is that it ends up functioning as a kind of shaming. Of course we reject all of the history of eugenics, but at the end of the day, we don't bend the stick so far to police certain ideas from even being discussable, especially ones that seem pretty plausible. And Joe, you had mentioned you kind of plead guilty to be part of the consensus in the field, but mm-hmm. I don't know, I hear people whose politics I don't share, but who scientifically seem plausible, who make the argument, look at countries in Scandinavia, where there's been decades of efforts to integrate STEM fields, and climates where there's not a lot of pressure, that the notion that there could be a kind of gravitational pull based on women tending to want to work with people more than men on average, again, these are averages, and men tending to want to work with things, could be part of the explanatory cocktail. It's not an advocacy of it. Mm-hmm. My politics are firmly in the camp of feminism. I identify as a feminism pretty deeply. But I think the conflation of trying to describe scientific and empirical processes with your normative stance is a problem that we encounter again and again, and it speaks again to the sort of explanatory framework we provide in the papers, which is that we're emotional communities, we're moral communities, we're not just scientific communities.
Yeah, that was the reaction that I had to the paper. And, you know, it's like I can see my own biases and see them as biases, and that sort of, it was an interesting paper in that way, like to get my head around it. Leslie, did you want to say something? Did I cut you off?
No. I mean, I was basically just going to say, you know, I mean, I think one of the places in which we actually see this advancing is in the whole field of sociogenomics, right? This idea, and I actually think it's smart. Like, I actually think sociologists should actually be like in the game of being able to sort of help interrogate, like, what's going on with our genome, and how much of, you know, what's going on, you know, given certain outcomes, you know, how much of it, what percentage of it is nature, right? You know, meaning like your genetic code, what percentage it is structure or your environment, right? And how can we help people who are in like the field of genomics to create better measures of those things that constitute the environment, right? In order to get a better understanding of what's going on. I'm all for it. The one thing that I worry about is at least some of the work that I've been seeing is, you know, this whole sociogenomics, it's like, it's all genetics, like, and the socio part is very light. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, hey, biologists, of course, because they're biologists, they believe that, you know, what drives stuff is biological. Sociologists, because they're sociologists, they believe that what drives stuff is like the social, yeah. Right? And I would hate to actually see sociology, you know, sort of like giving into like kind of like that status game of being like, oh, let's be more like biologists. Mm.
And I would add to that that there's, I agree with the dangers, Leslie, and there's powerful political economic forces, there's right-wing forces that'll use all of these ideas for nefarious political ends, but also empirically wrong reductionist arguments. So I agree we have to be in the game. Like, I don't think we can run away from it out of fear. I don't think that the findings, the genetic stuff I'm familiar with, suggests no role for the social. I think one of the sort of emerging consensus as I read it is that the vast majority of traits have at least, have around a half heritability factor to them. I mean, some of them are higher, like your physical height or something like that is much higher than half. But so yeah, there's a large role for our genes, but there's also an equally large role, and in some cases stronger role for society, and sociologists should be in the game in explaining that.
I have to say, on the power of biology, nothing so squarely pressed the power of biology into my face as having multiple children, because like, you raise them in more or less the same conditions, and they turn out so differently. And you notice that, I don't know. It's like you're surprised at how each one comes out so differently. I suppose nurture can still be at work, birth order or who knows what, but the role of biology is undeniable. I did want to talk about two really interesting findings that you had. One was your findings on the balance of objectivity and advocacy in the discipline, because they were really evenly split. So, for example, about 35% of sociologists you survey said that sociology is undermined by excessive activism, and 51% disagreed. Advocacy and research should be separate for objectivity. 44% agree, 43% disagree. Dispassionate attitude and research is important for accuracy. 47% agree, 39% disagree. So, I this objectivity argument that's been going on all semester long, I guess it really reflects a big cleavage in the belief system of our discipline, doesn't it? Like,
yeah, I have a lot to say on that, but I don't want to go in too long. So
that's okay.
Cut me off at any time.
All right. Well, do you want to say anything briefly, or?
Oh, do I want? Yeah, sure. I agree with what you just said, and I heard the earlier podcast you guys had done on this issue where you revisited it in terms of the president, I guess, elective ASA.
President now.
Okay. Yeah. The way I see it is I'm committed to the camp, if you want to call it that, of science approximating the truth. I'm not somebody who thinks we're getting the capital T truth when it comes to social science. I think few of us think that. And I think that it's a real problem to abdicate a commitment to that. I think it's empirically wrong on one level, but it's also politically disastrous. So it's empirically wrong just because we have methods and tools. Like we have data that gets constrained by having to present it to other sociologists, and our journals will debate the methods and so on. So it's simply not true that we don't better approximate the truth. But then I think you made this point, or maybe Gabriel did on the prior podcast, it's politically disastrous just because it feeds right into agendas that say, who says this plan would, get rid of pre-existing conditions, or it's up to the interpreter whether climate change is happening. Mm-hmm. So it's very dangerous to begin to speak of the professional legitimacy of what we do as sociologists as just a jockeying for power, mm-hmm. or to reduce our just a jockeying over discourse and power. I don't think it's true, and it's politically problematic. That said, I'm sorry, I'm speaking so fast here. That said, if you asked like 19 out of 20, the people who agree with President Romero on challenging objectivity, if you ask them about climate change, I think they'd all be lined up and say, it's a problem. We got to deal with it. Mm-hmm. So I say this not to call them out in their contradiction, but there is a contradiction. You really can't have your relativism and your climate change too, right? So what's going on there? And I think what's going on is that objectivity isn't what's being argued about. It's about a political positionality and a moral positionality. I think the people that are talking about objectivity and complaining about or critiquing it are really complaining about a kind of nonchalance among more moderate sociologists who don't share the same kind of passionate commitment to questions of vulnerable groups, right? They're not, their language game isn't the same when it comes to speaking to those deep emotional resonances. And that's really what they're opposed to. So they want to rattle the chain and say, we got to take these moral issues more seriously, people. And so that's my take on the objectivity debate.
Well, my take, so this is what I think, right? I think in the camp of people, right, who feel as though what Mary Romero's, her message is resonating with them. I think her message is resonating for multiple issues, right? I think some people in the camp are relativists, right? I think some people in the camp, right, are saying, this is about advocacy. But I also think a significant portion of people in the camp are saying, look, this is a moment for sociology to step back right? And think about, you know, all of the assumptions that undergird a lot of our work, right, that we take for granted, that perhaps we should be revisiting, because unless we do that, then the work that we do, right, without actually shedding light on those assumptions and critiquing them, that work will never be objective, right? And so I think that that there is a significant camp of people for whom that's what this message is about. It's not about relativism, right? It's not about there is no such thing as facts, mm-hmm. right? It's about saying sociology, if we really want to actually approach objectivity, we need to clean house and we need to start thinking about some of the assumptions that we make in our discipline that maybe really aren't objective at all.
So those are two different views. Like, Leslie, I would say your view will be strengthened if the ASA program has a lot of programming on methodology. Mm-hmm. And has like philosophers of science. If it has people who are upset about the conclusions that people reach because it's suppressing emancipatory research, then I think that would bear out Mark's explanation, right? Like, is it going to be technique or is it going to be you're not fighting the agenda? And you know what? Whoever is right, I guess it will shine through when we see the construction of the plenary sessions. And mm-hmm. and who's on the speaker's slate, but my guess is with Mark on this one, just because I haven't seen a lot of buzz around social science people, bringing in some heavy hitter philosophers of science to come. Look at those.
I can tell you, right, as a medical sociologist, mm-hmm. right, and like someone who's like in that camp of, you know, sociology of knowledge, mm-hmm. right, sociology of science, right, that last thing that I said, mm-hmm. right, that's what resonates with me, right, with what Romero, what her statement said. So that's exactly the way that I'm taking it. Mm-hmm. And I actually think that there are quite a few people like me, right, who, like, this is the way that we interpret Mary Romero's statement, right? And I'm not saying that's the only way to interpret it, but I'm saying that for me, right, that's the value of that statement to me.
And then one last one, because I know we got to wrap it up, but this one kind of blew my mind. And this is one where I'm going to adhere. I'm going to stick with my morality and not SC19 discussion of Muslim threat to values is Islamophobic. I think that's a completely Islamophobic thing. And 45% of our colleagues disagree. They feel like discussing Muslim threat is to values is not Islamophobic. I find that crazy Islamophobic, as if like one construing a threat from an entire religion and imputing like one set of values on a religion and then seeing it as a threat to our native values. I totally see that as Islamophobic. And I'm shocked that just under half of our colleagues don't see that as Islamophobic. Mark, what sort of reactions did you hear from this? Am I just refusing to let go of my, you know, my moral values, or?
Well, I think it's important to situate it, because again, we provide those vignettes, we provide an immigration vignette on this, mm-hmm. so it's in the context of flows of Muslims into Europe.
Okay.
So in that sort of broader context, because again, it depends on what we mean by Muslim threat to values. Mm-hmm. Obviously, those are kind of charged words.
Yeah.
But you know, to the extent that it's empirically measurable that people who would migrate to Europe might carry with them certain gendered attitudes, attitudes toward homosexuality, attitudes toward free speech regarding religion that choke against, you know, Western liberal sensibilities,
right?
Can you discuss that? Can we even have a study about that? Can we try to measure it without it inherently being Islamophobic? That was what we were at least going for in the survey. And I think that that might soften a little bit your view.
That does soften it.
Yeah, because even radical sociologists, only 41% agree that discussion itself of it is Islamophobic. And then it plummets. I mean, only 5% of moderates So very, very few moderate sociologists. And super, super fast, though, just because I love the way Leslie had framed her interpretation of Romero. And I can sort of like proudly say, like, that's exactly what I think I'm doing. I'm trying to do exactly what that's the part of Romero's statement, if interpreted that way, resonates with me, too. Like, the extent we become more self-aware of ourselves as a moral community, to the extent we lessen the likelihood of shaming each other. Because, by the way, I think all of us are attracted to it. We like feeling good about ourselves. So we like to shame. We should shame the racist, first of all, if we encounter one in our daily lives, right? But, you know, in academic life, I think we need to resist this temptation, try to step back, and be able to listen to what people say without being so trigger ready to gain the rewards of kind of virtue signaling within our moral communities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also too, I think it goes the other way too, right? I mean, you know, we know about the reward center of the brain, right? You know what I mean? And so how much is, you know, sort of like normative or like moralistic thinking within our field also driving people to actually create the kind of knowledge that they think, well, then, you know, have people calling them virtuous as well as good scholars, right?
Yes.
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.